and welcome to the Dairy Dialogue podcast, and this is number 102. It's also the last one in September, because today is the last day of September. I'm Jim Cornall, editor of Dairy Reporter, and this week, by some stroke of luck rather than incredible planning, we have a pretty long podcast, but I hope you'll agree it's a worthwhile subject, as we have three interviews with a common theme. Yesterday was the very first International Day of Awareness of Food Loss and Waste. And so to honour that day, today's podcast features three interviews related to the subject of food waste. Definitely not a day to celebrate, but hopefully it does bring some awareness to what is a massive issue globally. Of course, food waste has always been an issue, and it continues to be today, possibly more so than ever, especially with the pandemic creating such economic issues for so many people. And it's an incredibly sad story when you think about it. I was doing a search for some facts related to food waste, and according to the UK waste company Biffa, 13% of edible food and drink purchased by households in the UK are wasted. And UK households threw out £13.5 billion, or $17.3 billion, worth of edible food in 2015 alone. But it's not just households. The food service industry wastes an estimated $2.5 billion a year, that's $3.2 billion, in food waste. And some businesses in the UK spend 4 to 5% of their turnover just on waste disposal. Another incredibly sobering fact on a global scale is that we annually, between us, lose and waste 1.3 billion tons of food. That's a third of the world's entire food supply, or enough to feed 3 billion people. And there are still people starving, and I'm not just talking about in developing countries. I know there's often a big discussion about how we're going to feed the world's growing population, but clearly some of that has to come from not wasting food. If you care to look online, it won't take you long to search for and find plenty more equally depressing facts and figures about food loss and food waste. And because we're all part of the problem, we all need to be part of the solution. So this week we have three interviews on the subject, all in different capacities. We have conversations with Peter Thuyssen, Director of Commercial Development, Dairy Bioprotection at Christian Hansen, and then an interview with two people, Phil Van Trump, Chief Technology Officer at Danimer Scientific, and Tom Bowden, Chief Operation Officer at PSI. And then another with two guests, Realcor CEO Georges Blackman and Laurent Delal, Senior Scientist at the Department for Food Science at the University of Liège in Belgium. And we also have a weekly look at the global dairy markets with Liam Fenton from Stone X. Before we get to the news you may have missed over the past 7 days, I can tell you that locally not a lot happened, so that's that. And the main news obviously is still dominated by coronavirus. It was, as usual, another busy week at Dairy Reporter with lots of news, so let's take a look at what you may have missed over the last 7 days. Hochdorf is taking steps to strengthen the Bimbosan brand. Sadly, FIE and HIE, which were to take place in Germany in December, is now off, so that's my last trip of the year cancelled, and CFIA in Rennes in France has also been cancelled. That was a decent show when I went there a couple of years ago, and it would have been even bigger this year. In the US, the Dairy Alliance has a new CEO, and a survey commissioned by Ingredient Communications in the UK shows ingredient lists still aren't clear enough. Christian Hansen is selling its natural colours business to EQT. The rapid detection of A1 beta casein in milk is now possible through a new DNA-based test from Swiss Decode, and Finlandia cheese in the US is now known as Valio USA. CalBio, Dairy Farmers and Chevron have announced the first renewable natural gas in California. Nestle has launched an R&D accelerator to drive innovation for dairy and plant-based dairy alternative products. And a new report from the UK consumer group, Which, has criticised some cheese packaging for not being recyclable and others for not having recycling information on the packaging. You can read these and a whole lot more at dairyreporter.com. And so it's time for our first guest. Peter Tuesen is Director of Commercial Development, Dairy Bioprotection at Christian Hansen, and we chatted about food waste in general and shelf life, among many other things. As we're concentrating on food waste in the podcast today, I wonder if you could first start off by just running through what you see as the major categories in the food industry when it comes to waste.
When I look at the different categories and we look at all the research done, then what brings into mind and whatever was quite obvious to everyone, probably also intuitively, is that produce, fruit, vegetables is a big part of the food waste and loss throughout the entire supply chain in supermarkets and even in the households. I think the bread category, baking category is the second one. If we look at the subject that we are probably going to talk most about today, you and I, with the dairy part, where we have some solutions that can address food waste in yogurts and fermented milks and cheeses, that category does not spring up to mind as the one with the most waste. But then again, 17% of all yogurt produced in Europe is wasted. So even though it's not the top one, it's still 17% of all yogurt produced. That's a big waste. So I think when I look at it, there are so many things we can do in so many categories, and even categories that are not the ones that are most prone, the waste is there and we should address it if we can.
And do you think that global food manufacturers take food waste seriously enough?
I think that it's definitely coming onto the agenda and has come very strong onto the agenda the last couple of years. All the big guys in the field have this high on their priority list on the strategy. But when I look at actions, I think what I'm seeing is that a lot of the big global brands, a lot of the large organizations are really struggling with putting actions in place. So use a lot of time to find out, okay, how can we measure in the correct way? It seems that they feel it's a really, really difficult task to get to and complex. Where I see some of the ones we work with that has been more faster, more agile, smaller dairies, smaller food producers, who might from the get-go say, well, okay, it's complex and there are many elements and we could do 200 things, but here's three things that we know we can do now and that we could immediately start on. So let's do that. And then they start working. So I think that's where I would say most food producers don't take it seriously enough in terms of actually just getting to it and get some actions in place. Too much talk and too little action, but it's definitely changing. We are seeing a lot of the big food producers, both on national level, regional level, and global level, signing pacts. Just to mention one, pacts against food waste, just to mention some examples, there are a lot of activities around the world that this company, I don't know if you know them, Too Good To Go, is organizing different food producers, retailers, stakeholders from the food supply chain into pacts against food waste. And for example, in France, we are actually going to sign the pact against food waste that already quite some big dairy manufacturers have signed a little while ago. And we're signing it as we speak, actually, and going into that cooperation. So I'm seeing on the strategic level that it is definitely increasing and taking more and more serious.
Is there a fear among dairies or food manufacturers that if they initiate food waste reduction programs that they'll sell less food?
Yeah, I think that if we had this interview a couple of years ago where we also talked with dairies on this subject and were talking to them about our solutions, bioprotective solutions that could help extend shelf life of yogurt and what could that impact have on food waste reduction and so on. Actually, in many meetings, we would get that comment sort of that, yeah, but if consumers and retailers and everyone waste less, then it just means that we'll sell less, wouldn't it? I don't get that question anymore. So I think the big difference there is that people have started realizing that that's not how the world works. First of all, there are so many benefits in production setup, supply chains, to reduce food waste and to look at shelf life, improve shelf life, that the benefits outweigh the loss, the immediate loss, you could say there would be on a theoretical level. And then I think most producers, most dairies that we are working with these type of solutions, they also realize that they don't see that loss because they are able to use this as a differentiator. So they are able to use it as a differentiator to the retailer, becoming more attractive to the retailer. If you are someone who can supply a dairy product that actually stays fresh for longer on the shelf with the retailer and also gives the retailer something to talk about with his consumers on how it also stays more fresh in the consumer fridge and stays longer there and thereby waste less, then it's a differentiator in your relation to the retailer, and it's a differentiator of the product if you used it actively in your marketing efforts to consumers even. So you might even see an increase in sales. But overall, in a closed bubble, in a closed system, with the same amount of people buying the same amount of products, then yes, of course, it means less products are needed to feed the same people. But then the globe is expanding, right? We're becoming more and more people. And imagine people who today or in the past were considering where to spend their money and having an idea about the shelf life of fermented dairy products, for example, and maybe limiting the amount of that category that they would purchase because of a limited shelf life. And if they now find that the quality is better and lasts longer, maybe they would even increase a little bit the intake or the purchase in that category.
Over the past decade or so, there's been efforts to expand awareness of food waste. Is that enough, or do you think that more is necessary in that regard?
I think that we need to continue because we have to expand the awareness both for us in the value chain of food production and for the consumer, of course. There are lots of consumer campaigns, lots of activities, but I think, as an example, dialing in on the dairy part, bringing awareness of how much this actually is, and also bringing awareness of what are the factors that could change something. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the activities and campaigns and almost a movement that has been going on in Scandinavia over the last maybe 2 years, where we have always had this marking of dairy products with a best before expiry date. So consumers in Scandinavia are used to products that in theory they don't have to throw out when the date has been passed because it's just best before and they can evaluate the quality. However, the awareness of how to evaluate quality and that actually best before means that you can smell and look at it and taste the yogurt before throwing it out even after the best before date, that awareness has not been so big. So right now, there's really a big push that a lot of producers put best before, and then they even signal in the dating saying best before this and this date, often good after. And they put informations on the labels and the commercial activities talking about how you as a consumer should evaluate the product before you throw it out, also after its best before date. That's one of the areas where I think we could really, really change a lot. I think I read somewhere that it's still 68% of all yogurt in Europe is sold with a use by date. To me, that's just ridiculous. And I think most people in the dairy industry who knows about fermentation and who knows about quality of fermented dairy and would say, well, we know that you can evaluate the quality of the product and that it might also be really good after the sell-by date or the best before date. So why is it that we actually signal use by? I think in UK, there was a study saying that 50% of what households throw out in the yogurt category is thrown out unopened. So simply looking at the date and not even opening it and evaluating the quality, because a lot of those products could have been consumed and would have been great. So I think that's an area where we should, you could say on the consumer level, we could help as an industry and regulators, policymakers could help create awareness of what best before means in those places where best before is actually in place. And then of course, in the places where it is a use by dating, why not from the industry also push and help change that? That would create a big difference in the food waste.
Yeah, definitely. And I think education is an important aspect of that as well. I know that in many schools around the world, they teach nutrition, and yet they don't really teach anything about things like shelf life. Because I know my son is 8 years old and he won't touch anything in the fridge. If it says October 1st and it's October 2nd, he just says, well, no, the it's past the date when you can eat it. So I think education is a key part of that as well.
For sure, for sure. Education is a huge key. And of course, it's really, really important to have, you know, there are some food categories where it has to be used by, right? And where there is a real food safety risk connected to the dating. And those categories, of course, used by, and there it's important that your son actually knows, okay, with these types of food, it says used by, and I'll stick to that. But then there are other types of food, and fermented dairy and cheeses, they are in that category, as I see it, where best before means you can actually evaluate it and look at it, smell it, taste it before throwing it out.
Do you think there's a bit of a disconnect in the fact that, especially after coronavirus, people want good, healthy, natural food? And yet, in a lot of cases, we're talking about different measures to extend shelf life. Do you think that they're kind of opposed to each other?
Yes, I think actually they do oppose each other initially, and for years there's been this. It's not a trend, right? But for years we've been talking about that consumers want more real food, less artificial ingredients, or with no artificial ingredients. We want to connect and understand what's on that ingredient label, right? Clean label, transparency, all of that plays into it. And then when we talk shelf life extension, traditionally, this has been about adding something artificial then, right? And I think that's definitely something that plays into this, where you could very easily imagine that we as consumers are more weary about products that has more shelf life than what we are used to. Here's, I think, also an educational element, and this thing about best before, often good after, and about how to evaluate quality plays into it. I think the more we as consumers understand that part, the more we can also accept a longer shelf life. And actually you have started the dialogue as a food producer with consumers about the importance of that shelf life and the impact on food waste. We did an interesting study, I think last year, where we looked specifically at this. We had our cultures with bioprotective effect that in the fermentation mix helps the yogurt stay fresh a little longer. So we conducted a study, I believe it was in Germany, where we looked at yogurts with the normal average German shelf life and then yogurts with the better fermentation mix and the shelf life. We just added 7 days more. It could have been much more, but we wanted to be realistic in terms of the first steps that you as a food, as a dairy would take. So we added 7 days more, and the consumers in the tests, first of all, liked the product equally much when they were presented and tasted it blind. But then we also investigated this part about if we then tell them that it has been extended, what's happening with their purchase intention? Because that was the interesting, it was actually your question. We wanted to investigate that. And we saw that as soon as we told them why we had extended it, and of course also told them that we did it by improving the fermentation, the cultures and the fermentation. So we told them we are extending shelf life in order to really address food waste, because it has a big impact. There's a big correlation between how much shelf life and how much food waste there is. And we did it in a natural way. And that actually ended up increasing their purchasing intention. So they wanted the products with longer shelf life, and they were also willing to pay more for them. And for me, that's what has changed the last couple of years, that the dialogue on shelf life is actually now legitimized because of the food waste discussion. So because of consumers actually starting to choose products on the shelf in the supermarket that has a better impact sustainability wise, and food waste is high on that agenda. And because of that, they accept things that they didn't accept before. Of course, you still have to do it in the right way. We can't just use all the different chemicals and so on and get an infinite shelf life. That's not what I'm talking about. We still need to keep it natural and keep it real, for sure. But the fear about talking of shelf life extension with consumers, I think that if we include the food waste discussion into that, then it could actually surprise many of us working in the food industry.
And following on from that, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of food is wasted by the consumer and it's sometimes hard for them to change their habits. What do you think can be done at the consumer level without necessarily needing to change their habits?
Yeah, that's one of the things that when I mentioned some dairies just realizing here's something we can do. There's many other things we can do as well, and we can put many levels on top, but we can just do this one and it will actually help to some extent. And here, if you look at shelf life, so even if we did not manage to educate all consumers about how they can evaluate the quality also after the best before date, and even if we didn't manage to change the places where it's still used by, if we extended the shelf life, if we extended the date marking with a week, we improved quality so that it would be possible to do that. And if, of course, did it still with real food ingredients and real food, then we as consumers wouldn't have to change behaviors, right? Then products would just have a longer date marking on it, and we would save a lot of waste. We did an impact study for EU a couple of years ago showing that, so out of these 17% of yogurt that's wasted in the EU, if you extend it with 7 days, you would actually save 30% of that waste. And that's the direct savings without adding the layers of consumers actually learning more about quality and best before and also consuming afterwards. It's only taking into account the savings in production waste and the supply chain and the direct savings because you have a longer dating.
In some places, there are a lot of food recycling programs. Do you think that this is enough? And can governments on both the national and local level be doing a bit more? Or do you think that also food waste recycling feeds into a bit of a sense of security that while it's not really wasted, we're recycling it?
I like how you phrase it, a sense of security. So I think food waste recycling programs, I'm all for that. And I think we should do as much as we can to recycle the food waste we have, for sure. And there are probably, I'm not an expert in that area, but there are probably a lot more we can do, both as consumers and food producers and governmental side. I'm sure of that. But I would, of course, like that from a starting point, waste less food. So if we have less food to recycle, that would be even better, right? It gives a sense of security, like you're saying that, okay, but we, at least when we waste things, it's not going completely to waste. And that's good. Let's get something out of what we waste. But the root of the problem is the initial waste we have, right? And any measures we can do to reduce that. You ask about governments and regulators, this dating, best before use by. It's simply strange that even in a European Union that we have no alignment of this. Why have we different ways of doing it? Why is it used by on a yogurt in Spain and best before, often good after in Denmark? That doesn't make sense to me when it's pretty clear to everyone, even I should say legislatures, that of course that would have a very positive impact. So that's an area I would address.
So you think then it's mainly a combination of sort of increased shelf life, better packaging, consumer awareness, it's a whole thing rather than just one?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm also sometimes asked that question, maybe you're actually going to ask it afterwards, but I'll just go ahead before you ask it.
Sure.
Because I think I'm often asked the question, yeah, but okay, so you have something that can help us get a better quality and thereby enable a longer shelf life. But is that the most impactful thing we can do in order to reduce waste? It has a big impact, so we should do it. But are there other things we can do? Yes, there are. And probably what we need to do is work on a lot of different levels and with a lot of different activities at the same time. I would think that's the way to go. And each of us plays a role in different parts of the whole food system. So let's look at our part of the food system and say, what is it we can do? And then start doing that. And then help, of course, highlight the places where it's important to understand how much you can get out of different activities. And it's important, of course, to prioritize efforts and put a lot of efforts into those things that can have really a big difference, for sure. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do also some of the other things. So in terms of shelf life, you already said it. So we are an ingredient supplier, and we have an ingredient that can help here. But of course, in a specific product, maybe that's one element of shelf life, and maybe we can get even further with further improving packaging, and maybe we can get even further in the way we're selling things, and maybe we can get further in the way we're labeling and all those elements, right? And storing and all of that, right? So it plays together for sure.
Do you think it's an area that's going to be more important in the future?
I definitely think so. What I'm seeing around the globe, I have this privilege of overseeing the bioprotection business in Chr. Hansen around the globe. Of course, there are parts of the world where this debate and the awareness about how much problems food waste is causing, and that 8% of greenhouse emissions is globally is caused by food waste. And in other places, there are other agendas that are more prevalent, but it's pretty clear to me that in all corners of the world, we are talking about food waste already now. And to me, that just points out that even in places where you would think that food waste would maybe not be the first point, it is coming up really high on the agenda at the moment. And policymakers are making new policies. The Chinese president has recently put really, really strong talk into the food waste and how we need to set national targets and objectives. And I think in Europe, in our part of the world here, Europe, North America, many mature markets, I see consumers taking action, and I see how it's turning into a marketing differentiator with food companies and retailers. And it does that because it means something to consumers, right? So we all take part in this change, and we act when we buy products in the supermarket. We buy political, and we choose things that are more sustainable. So I think it will be more and more important. And I think producers and people in this in the value chain that don't realize it fast enough, they will have problems.
Just in passing, though, you mentioned targets. Is that something that you're able to help your own customers to do, is to meet their own targets in terms of reducing food waste?
Yes, of course. Many customers do put up own targets at the moment, right? And of course, improving the quality of the food and yogurt or fermented milk, just as an example, will also help them achieve those targets faster. I think just on a practical level, what I'm seeing initially when customers put up targets, they are very cautious not to put up targets for the full supply chain. And I, of course, understand that the waste that you can manage is the waste that you have in your own system, right? In your production, in your storage. And then when you send it out on the truck afterwards, it's more difficult to manage that part. But that's maybe where an area that I would find a little bit of pity that we as food manufacturers and producers don't actively go into alliances with retailers for specific targets on specific product categories or products. But even if you have, let's say, an internal target in a dairy, a lot of having more time available to produce and to handle logistics and optimize both production runs and supply chains can save a lot of waste. We have customers who've been able to reduce the number of production runs they run on a specific product because now that they have more shelf life, they're able to run bigger batches with fewer productions per week. So they're able to utilize their production setup much more efficiently, and also meaning reducing changeovers and cleanings where you would have quite a lot of waste happening in the system. So even in the internal waste, they are meeting targets easier.
Now we go to Belgium for Realco, a company that has been working on food waste through extending shelf life. Only this is through reducing bacterial contamination through cleaning. But I'll let our two guests explain, and they are Realco CEO Georges Blackman and Laurent Delalle, senior scientist at the Department for Food Science at the University of Liège in Belgium.
Okay, so I guess we'll start with Georges. I wonder if you could give me a little bit of background about Realco.
Of course. So Realco, we call it Realco, and not Realco, is a company located in the center of Belgium, very close to Brussels. We employ around 60 people, and including 7 people in R&D. So we do quite a lot of innovation. And what we do is that we develop solutions coming from the green chemistry for cleaning and for wastewater treatment. But here we are here today to talk mainly about cleaning. with solutions coming from the green chemistry. Our main solutions are based on enzymes, and because enzymes have great properties, and because enzymes, we believe, are the future because it's a sustainable solution. And actually, in the food industry, enzymes have a lot of interest for many reasons that we'll describe later. And it can be in any kind of sector in the food and beverage industry, and in particular in the dairy industry.
Before we talk about the research, it's often interesting to talk about what the issue was that you were addressing in the first place. So could you tell me what the problem was and what you were looking into?
You know, a big problem for the world, let's say, is the waste of food. You know that the FAO considers that one-third of the food that is produced is actually lost or wasted. It represents 1.3 billion tons of waste per year in the world. And in Europe, it represents 88 million tons. So you see, it's a huge problem, an economical problem, but also an ecological problem. And we wanted to not to tackle that problem, but we wanted to, with our solutions, to participate in the decrease of that waste. And one of the solutions is to work on the shelf life of the finished goods. And we know that by cleaning better, we wanted to prove that by cleaning better, the finished goods, the food, would be increased in quality. And if the quality of the food is increased, you can therefore logically also increase the shelf life of those products. This is what we wanted to prove in that study that we did in the last 3 years.
One of the things with increasing the shelf life is you're not doing it by adding all kinds of chemicals to the food itself, because I guess one of the big things right now, especially with coronavirus, people want natural products, so you're not doing it with additives.
No, of course. Our mission is to help environment and health. So, of course, the idea is to decrease the number of preservatives instead of increasing it. One of the ways is to have a better hygiene in the environment, in the facilities of the food and beverage industry.
And how did the research project come about?
There, I think Laurent will explain. I can give you general information, but I think if you want good information, Laurent was the leader of that research, so I think he will explain you a little bit more about it.
Yes, so first, the objective of the study is to compare the efficiency of enzymatic cleaning with conventional cleaning, so with chemicals. And we compare the different type of cleaning in food installation and the potential impact on the food product. So it's a large scale study in collaboration with the University of Liège and a laboratory specialized in molecular biology. And this study includes 6 big companies for 2 years. And the companies are representative of the food sector. It includes a ready-to-eat industry, a cutting meat plant, a dairy industry, a collective kitchen, butcheries, etc. Almost 1,000 samples were collected during this study and analyzed with different techniques, with classical microbiology and with a powerful molecular technique called metagenomic to describe the bacterial flora on the surface of the installation and on inside the food product.
And what were the findings of the study?
So in this study, we have scientifically proven that enzymatic detergent is more efficient than conventional chemistry solution to clean food industry. And moreover, this better efficiency increases the shelf life of perishable food products, and so we reduce food losses. So, for example, in the dairy industry, we have evaluated the cleaning of specific equipment, such as the pasteurizer. As you know, a thin layer of biofouling in the pasteurizer could reduce drastically the efficiency of this pasteurizer. And this biofouling is not eliminated with chemical cleaning, even with very aggressive solutions, such as caustic soda or acid. But the biofouling is eliminated with enzymatic detergent, and the efficiency of the pasteurizer is increased 20 times after the treatment. So we have, at the end, a better efficiency of this equipment and a better microbial quality of a food product. In that case, it was a cheese product.
Should we explain a little bit further what is a biofilm? Because we have a patent on a solution based on enzymes that will destroy biofilms. And it's one of the reasons why our solutions are better in terms of performance.
Yeah, and also maybe how the enzymic action works.
In general words, you know, biofilms is the combination of bacteria and the shelter that the bacteria will create around them to protect themselves from the environment. We are tempted to consider that bacteria are alone, but actually 99% of the bacteria are living inside a biofilm. And this shelter is made of a polymeric substance and proteins and created by the bacteria themselves. They use it as a protective layer. So it means that they will resist quite strongly all the different disinfectant or any kind of mechanical action. And we consider, and it's studies consider that bacteria inside the biofilms are up to 1,000 more resistant to disinfectant. So it means you should increase the dosage by 1,000 to have the same effect. And the reality is that in the industry, a lot of biofilms are not destroyed and remain on the installation. And it's invisible, of course, so you believe everything is clean, but things are not clean. And we have a patent to detect those biofilms, but also to eliminate those biofilms using our enzymatic technology. And that's the reason why, by using this green chemistry, you can get superior performance compared to traditional chemistry.
Clearly very important for the food industry.
Yeah, exactly. It is, and I think it's more and more considered. So I would say 10 years ago, when we made our patent on the elimination of biofilms, we had to convince the food sector that those biofilms exist and was actually a problem. It was very difficult because most of the people were not aware of that. Now we are 10 years later, and honestly, it's something that is known in the industry. So now it's at least easier to consider the existence and to believe in the existence of biofilms, what was not the case 10 years ago. But now we have to convince the industrials that biofilms are present in their installations, what is not always accepted.
Maybe I could complete with some information. The biofilms are everywhere in the environment and, of course, are everywhere in the food production system. And inside the biofilm, so it's a very complex structure that includes different kind of bacteria. You can find spoiling bacteria, for example, and you have also pathogens. So it's very important to consider the presence of this biofilm. So even if your surface looks clean, you have presence of biofilms inside your system. And even if you use very aggressive chemicals to clean your systems, the biofilm could resist. For example, the bacteria present inside the biofilm are 1,000 times more resistant to disinfectant, to very aggressive chemical agents, because they are behind a shelter. And this shelter is composed of different molecules. It's a mix of proteins, of glucides and lipids. And this mix of molecules are very difficult to destroy with conventional techniques.
As far as you have the detection solution and you also have the enzymes to deal with this problem, how easy is it for companies to use? Do they use it themselves or do you go into their facility and clean it yourself?
So we provide a service, but just to train the team to clean by themselves. So we are not a cleaning company, but we have a team of experts traveling around the world to make either curative treatment. You know, when you have a big contamination in a plant, you want to have the help of experts. We will send you our experts. They will treat the plant, but they will also train the employees of that plant to make it by themselves next time it happens, or if they want to set up a preventive plan.
I was going to ask how cost-effective it is for companies, but obviously if they're improving shelf life and improving efficiency, then they have their savings right there.
Yeah, I think it's something, you know, we have already thousands of customers around the world, but definitely we hope that this study will bring us more and will help us to continue our development and to boost our development.
And what are the next steps for your company to to sort of turn this research into reality, I guess.
And next steps is to convince all the plants in the food and beverage industry to believe and to apply our solutions, because we believe we can have a big impact. I can conclude by saying we are very proud of this study. So I want to thank Laurent for that, because we finally can prove that green chemistry can make better than conventional chemistry. And that's a big achievement.
And our third look at different aspects of food waste takes us to the US for another interview with two people, and it's with two companies, Danimer Scientific and Plastic Suppliers Inc., or PSI, who have partnered on the creation of bio-based home compostable films. And our two guests are Phil Van Trump, Chief Technology Officer at Danimer Scientific, and Tom Bowden, Chief Operation Officer at PSI. Okay, so if we could get things started by talking a little bit about your respective companies.
Yeah, this is Phil, and I'm with Danimer Scientific, and our company was founded in 2004, and we really focus on biopolymers themselves. So we just produce, polymer pellets. We don't produce actual products, which Tom's company does, but we focus on a wide range of applications, including, films like what Tom produces, but other things like cutlery or injection molded articles. And our company really focuses on a newer material, PHA, which is a biodegradable polymer that can be used just like polypropylene or polyethylene or PET materials that you see in the market today. So we have manufacturing facilities in both Georgia and Kentucky in the United States. Tom?
Tom, I'm with PSI, and we manufacture compostable, sustainable biopolymer films and also shrink sleeve decoration films under the Earth First brand name. So the company is global. We're headquartered in Ohio, and we have a manufacturing site in Belgium, which covers the geographies outside of the Americas. We take materials from Phil's company and also other base raw material suppliers, PLA suppliers, to make our films. And we've been in operation for about 70 years.
How did the partnership come about on the current project?
Sure. So kind of as we've talked a little bit about, PSI and Danimer have been working together for well over a decade, bringing these biopolymer solutions to the market. Danimer has a tremendous expertise in the field of additives and formulas. So they've helped us in many respects co-develop some of the products that we brought to market. And in the space where we're playing in compostable space, we recognize that end of life is an important characteristic, and we want to enhance the end of life options. So both of our companies have a priority and a passion for doing that, to help the environment in that respect. So this PHA partnership is clearly aligned with that goal, and it was a natural evolution of our long and valued relationship together.
You couldn't have said it better, Tom. And due to us or Danimer, just producing the plastic pellets, we obviously need partners in order to, produce the polymers into materials. And Tom's company is, progressive and has really pretty much been the leader and the first company to really focus on these materials. And they've been doing it for well over a decade before most folks even knew about compostable packaging.
Yeah, because it does seem like it's something that's just happened, but I do remember that there has been compostable packaging for quite some time now.
Yeah, I think, Jim, the adoption has taken a long, long time, and I think Phil would agree that just over the last 12 months, it's gone from speed of 5 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour. That rapid change has brought a lot of it to the fore. But you're absolutely right. These materials, some of these materials, PHA not included, but compostable materials have been around for several decades. It's nothing new on much of the technology side till now.
In that respect, though, I would assume that it's improved and become more cost effective?
Yeah. Over the years, the scale has increased. So I think in general, costs have been stabilized. Because these are newer materials and, the industry is growing, there needs to be, reinvestment. So cost has come down, but demand has gone up at the same time. So, you know, here recently, you know, some costs have gone up, but in general, the industry has been growing at a rapid rate. So, you know, we foresee the uptick in volume that, as Tom noted, the, over the last 12, 24 months has been exponential will definitely help drive down costs just because the scale is exploding.
Just in the last 5 days, there have been two press releases from the major PLA suppliers, one announcing a 10% expansion in their main facility in the U.S. by the end of 2021, and then the second largest producer just announced a 200 million euro new facility in France that will be operational in 2024. So again, while these materials have been around for a long, long time, the demand did not kind of force this type of expansion, and it's happening very quickly now. You think 2024 is a long time, but it's a very complex, capital-intensive expansion, so it does take time. One of the things to note about the cost effectiveness, so as Phil said, as scale increases over the coming years, we do expect them to become more cost effective. But I think it's important to note that you do get many benefits from the materials in this space. And in the case of our films, they allow source reduction today in addition to compostability. And the source reduction in packaging mass does save money up and down the supply chain. So when you think about the cost, I think it's important to remember what's being delivered in terms of the environmental benefits, the reduced environmental impact of being renewably sourced, creating lower greenhouse gas emissions throughout the life cycle, and then having a positive end of life solution. I think we talk about there's a per pound cost, but you really got to look at the whole system cost. And in many cases, just within the packaging space, there's a lot of offsetting benefits to this by down gauging and, you know, that source reduction. So I think it's a big picture, not solely based on a cost per pound answer. I would say that brands recognize that. I'm pleased to say that brands are very committed to finding all the solutions, whether they be compostable or recyclable or reusable. They all need to succeed in order to benefit the planet. So it's not just all about compostability, and we would never say that this is the only solution and this is the best solution. They all have to succeed. And I think the brands are truly committed, and that's very gratifying to us.
So what issues are you trying to address here?
A big chunk of the plastics that are utilized in the world are never recycled. And that's due to economics, as well as, you know, you put food products and things like films and they get contaminated. So in order to be effectively recycled, they need to be, you know, gathered and then cleaned and then put back into flake or pellet so that can be reprocessed into another article. And the real challenge with films and many other plastics that are used today is, you know, the mass, right? They don't weigh that much. So just thinking of the whole supply chain of gathering all of these things back up and, you know, cleaning them and reprocessing them, it would be very, very costly and very, very difficult. There's that challenge. And then there's also the challenge of, depending on where you're at in the world, you may not even have access to recycling at all. So when you couple different parts of the world and how much infrastructure they have, and then just the reality of what the plastic article is, there's just tremendous challenges to dealing with the end of life of these materials. You know, they're filling up our landfills, they're being leaked into the environment. These new materials, these new resins, you know, that Tom can turn into films, have a different end of life. So they can be industrial composted, but they can also be composted at home or community compost facilities. You know, that's a real advantage of these type materials, is we can open up the options for the end of life where they're not ending up potentially in landfills. And, you know, there's an opportunity for nature to recycle these materials, you know, rather than for them to build up in the environment, whether they're leaked or whether they're in landfills, et cetera. Tom?
So, you know, we talk about home compostability options were limited in the packaging space. To now, there were very few. And soil and marine compostability and degradability options are even more limited if they truly exist at all in a functional way. So, you know, the key focus, the way we look at PHA and this partnership, is to develop packaging film solutions with these expanded compostability options in mind. I mean, that's the primary reason for us to be working with Danimer on in the PHA space. And the other important piece about PHA, which I don't think has been mentioned up to this point, is the biopolymers on the market today are limited in number, and therefore they're limited in terms of what you can do with them, how you can blend them together or get different characteristics. There's only so many things you can do with three different materials. What PHA brings to the party is a tailorability of different characteristics. And Phil could tell you all the technical details of how that all works, but just kind of boil it down to say that if you wanted something to have a higher heat resistance or be softer or have another characteristic, those are to a large degree tailorable. And so it brings a tremendous number of options to the compostable packaging space that didn't used to be there. So if you'll remember all the way back to the Sun Chips product back in the day, very noisy, very crinkly, got killed early on. But that was pretty much what PLA could deliver and the adhesives could deliver at that time. Now we have other solutions today that address that, but PHA will enhance that. So as the brands and consumers look at what they want out of their packaging, PHA will help us bring solutions that weren't available before.
Just as an aside here, is this packaging that would be printable?
That's part of our development. So as you know, the press release just came out very recently. And so we're just now starting the testing and the trialing internally. But that is one of our targets, is to be able to provide potentially even a complete structure, if one wanted it, of PHA-based films.
What benefits will this bring for food manufacturers and ultimately for the end consumer?
So I think there's great benefits for both manufacturers and consumers. If you start with food manufacturers, I think no matter what their sustainability objectives are, whether it's compostability or plant-based packaging or less reliance on fossil fuels or material source reduction, lower carbon footprint, I think these films will meet all of these characteristics. So there's that attainment of the sustainability goals and an arrow in their quiver to be able to achieve that, certainly in certain applications. For the consumer, they will still likely be able to notice a difference in the feel and sound of a compostable packaging versus what they're used to with traditional petroleum-based. They'll still get the integrity and the functionality that they expect and that the brands require. But again, as we talked about, the benefit of adding PHA is it allows us to get movement within that space, that customer experience space, so that we could either get closer to what they're used to or maybe even, you know, as we've talked about internally, create the sound of sustainability, meaning that a sound might be indicative of the product having an environmentally responsible impact. So at the end of the day, the more end-of-life streams that we can create, coupled with a greater consumer experience than they perhaps had in the past, that should maximize the adoption and thus the positive environmental impact. That's what both our companies are about, is being environmentally conscious and responsible and giving brands and retailers solutions so that they can do the same.
You know, just echoing some of his thoughts, you know, the consumer wants options, right? You know, in the last 5 years, even the last, you know, 12 to 24 months, you know, the plastics issue is more fundamentally known globally. You know, consumers, especially younger consumers, are asking for newer materials and are thinking about the impact of, you know, the things that they buy every day on the environment. So that having these materials available and offering a different ultimate end of life for the materials, being home compostable, most certainly we think will resonate with a lot of consumers.
And you mentioned the younger consumers there. Maybe having a different sound or a different feel to it is a selling point that they will find attractive.
Jim, that's a very good point. And somehow we broadly, which is the suppliers and the industry and brands and retailers, do need to be able to differentiate and direct consumers on what they're looking at. You look on the shelf and you see a lot of different claims, or you don't see claims, or you see certifications on the back of the package. And the consumer, I think, is not very well directed as to what they're looking at. whether that's the feel, the look, the sound, or a symbol or a color or a, you know, starburst, a, you know, brown starburst, it means it's compostable or something. We collectively have an obligation to figure out how are we going to get the consumer to know what they're looking at, be able to make buying decisions based on that if it's important to them, and then know what to do with the package when they're done. If we don't do that part, that still ends up in the landfill or a contaminant in the recycle stream, for example, that doesn't complete the loop for us. So we've got to work on the infrastructure, work on the education, work on the ability to, say, short circuit industrial composting with home composting, because if it never leaves the consumer's house and they know what to do with it, then it won't leak into the environment because it's being put there. And so there's a whole myriad of things that we need to do to educate the consumer, build the infrastructure, build the process, and make sure we maximize the benefits of all the work and all the material investment that's been made.
We mentioned cost effectivity a little bit earlier with respect to the overall compostable packaging, but in terms of your own product, will it be cost effective, and will manufacturers need additional equipment to be able to utilize it?
So from our perspective, no. The converters and the fillers will not need additional equipment. And we found that out with our current biopolymer products. They run on the same equipment as the petroleum-based counterparts. PHA films should be no different at all. Usually you will change process settings. In many cases, you'll go down in temperature and you'll save energy and wear and tear on the equipment. But so far, we've seen very good success with maintaining packaging speeds and running on the existing equipment base, which is critically important. I've seen technologies in the packaging space and been involved in them, and it might have been a revolutionary packaging format change, and it failed only because it couldn't run as fast and it couldn't run on the same equipment. You needed to buy new equipment. So we recognize that the path to success and adoption goes through work on the existing equipment. That's what we've seen so far.
The next steps, obviously, you're developing these products. What are the next steps towards making this a commercial reality?
And so from our perspective at Danimer, we're focused on scaling up our PHA production. So we're doing that at our Kentucky facility. The facility's been up and running for about a year now, and we're currently planning and about to start a expansion of the facility so we can supply more resins to Tom for his packaging. The real challenge just from the resin side is to continue to expand capacity, because polymer production facilities are capital intensive. The biopolymers are just like the traditional petro-based polymers. You know, the facilities are larger and it takes a lot of capital. So we're focused on expanding our capabilities and our manufacturing, as well as working with Tom to narrow down the exact properties he needs to make his products for his customers.
So from PSI's perspective, as we speak, we're running internal trials on pilot equipment on a variety of new products and formulations from Danimer. This work's going to continue throughout 2021. I think based on some of the things that we've already seen and we know and co-developing with Danimer, we would expect probably in the Q2 type timeframe of 2021, we'd start bringing products to our portfolio that would have these expanded characteristics. And then there's a long list, as we talked about, there's a long list of things that PHA can do. So that development commercialization is going to continue. I see it continuing throughout 2022 as we not only kind of expand the end of life options, but bring those films with other characteristics. And there's only so much you can do in the pipeline. And there's a lot that PHA can do, we believe. So I think there's going to be a lot of work going on. Product delivery, in mid-2021 is what we expect today.
It's good that it will be available relatively soon. And I guess there are also other important aspects of this kind of packaging.
You know, one of the important things that we like to talk about that a lot of people don't talk about is just the issues with food waste. So, you know, there's a lot of food that ends up in landfills, you know, and can cause greenhouse gas emissions and fill up our landfills. You know, utilizing these films along with food waste in a home compost environment, I think it can be, you know, synergistic to, you know, solving a couple issues at once, like, you know, our plastics issue, but, you know, also food waste issues and dealing with those, as Tom noted, you know, right there at the consumer.
With regards to composting, I think we all need to, just like we talked about, we all need to reinforce the standardized message to the consumer. I think we all need to support the infrastructure expansion because, you know, without that continuing to go on, the composting infrastructure is expanding at a very high rate compared to, say, recycling. It's starting from a much smaller space, so higher percentage is not unexpected. But we need to build on that, and it's not fully developed today. But they are, again, better for the environment because of all the things we've talked about. And I think it's important just to kind of reach out and say brands and retailers and converters can take positive sustainability actions today, even if the infrastructure is not quite ready to maximize those benefits. And therein lies the question that everyone asks themselves, do I need to wait for the final perfect solution, or do I start moving where I can? And I think we look at recycling, for example, 9% in the US and 14% in Europe. Those are kind of abysmal numbers. And compostability, industrial composting, is much less than that. So I'm not picking on recycling, but recycling's been around for a long, long time, and it's not by itself the perfect solution. So we want to progress with recyclable options, but we also want to progress with the other options that make it, even though the infrastructure is not there. So even imperfect solutions. And quite frankly, we hope that we can develop soil and marine compostable solutions using PHA, because there's always going to be leakage from the system, unintentional. But when that leakage happens, we want our packages, the responsible package, goes away. Whether it goes away in 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, if you do the math and you look at a traditional package that takes 200 to 500 years to go away, what leaks today is going to be there 200 years from now. If you look at a package that contains PHA, and if we can develop that package such that it goes away in 1 to 2 years, the difference to the environment is miraculous.
And what would ideal applications of this packaging be?
As with our current portfolio from PSI, we look at all packaging formats, flexible packaging formats, as fair game for our products. And I think that's, again, true with the PHA materials. So whether they be stand-up pouches or bag-in-box or whatever the case may be, you know, within the dairy space, I think you could foresee opportunities and technical solutions in the shrink sleeve decoration for dairy packages, if they can be separated from their containers, if the containers are not compostable. You know, butter stick pack wrap might be an opportunity that would certainly work. Lidding films, stand-up pouches for dairy products such as cheese packaging, I think are all potential applications for this technology. And I think the addition of PHA, again, expands our capability and reach into the end-use application. So all good things come with this lever that Danimer has given us with this technology. And so I think it has broader reach than even our products did before. And we hope that comes to fruition.
Now it's over to Dublin for our weekly look at the global dairy markets with Liam Fenton at Stone X.
This week was a quiet week for skim milk powder, really, from the perspective of price movement. While there was quite a bit of trading, skim milk powder continues to remain firm. Butter, on the other hand, seems to have taken a bit of a dip. I think worries in relation to demand for butter, given the overall macroeconomic effect of Corona and the effects that's going to have on demand is concerning a lot of processors and sellers. Skim milk powder has remained relatively stable as it's more or less expired today, actually. And price movement on the quotations have been slow to follow the spot market. So September was down around 20 euros to 34.25 level. Quarter four then was down around 40 euros to 33.50 level. And quarter one, which has seen most of the action, has been down around 120 euros to 32.40 level. Quarter two was also back a little bit, but not so much trading as quarter one, but back around 70 euros a ton to 3,300. Skim milk powder, as I say, remains stable. September was around the 21.85 level, 21.75 level last week. Quarter four, no change there, still around the 22.20 level. Quarter one, also around the same level, 22.40, 45 level. And quarter two, slightly stronger at maybe 22.70, 80 level, up about 10, 20 euros a ton. Whey was also relatively constant.
Thanks, Liam. We'll talk to you again next time.
StoneX, formerly INTLFC Stone, provides risk management and margin hedging programs and services, as well as OTC hedging tool and M&A advisory services to the global dairy industry. And that does it for Podcast 102 on food waste. I hope that you enjoyed it and that it gave you something to think about at least, and hopefully we can all work together for a world with less food waste and maybe even less hunger. Here in our little corner of the world, we do have food waste collection every Wednesday, and we probably have about a third of a small bucket, which I guess isn't too bad, but what's sad is there are maybe half a dozen people in the entire village that bother to put the container out every week. So education is definitely important as we try to make this a better place for everyone. Next week, I'm hoping we have some more details for you about the live webinar in November, which is pretty much like the podcast, only because it's live, you'll hear more of my mistakes than usual, and less music. Actually, no music, unless I or one of the guests has it on in the background and forgets to turn it off. The joys of working from home during the pandemic. I actually did an interview this week where my wife's cooking set the smoke detector off, so looking forward to trying to remove that from the interview. But editing that is a few days away yet. So I hope you will join us again next time. Have a great week, stay safe, take care, and as always, wherever you are, thanks for listening.